From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Medicine and poetry, those are topics that one might not ordinarily associate with one another. But according to one scholar who recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, the connection between the two is strong in the life and poetry of John Keats, the English romantic poet who lived from 1795 till 1821. Hermione de Almeida, a professor of English at the University of Miami, is completing a book that investigates the extent to which John Keats relied on medical concepts and the ways in which medicine influenced his intellectual and poetic development. Hermione de Almeida was educated at Vassar College and Columbia University. She's the author of Byron and Joyce Through Homer, a study of Byron's Don Juan and Joyce's Ulysses. It's unusual that a poet would be interested in medicine. Or is it unusual? Are you setting out to prove that that is not the case?
I suppose I'm trying to prove that it's not the case. But in fact, at least in the early 19th century, mm-hmm. medicine was one of the very strong interests of a lot of the poets of the time. In Keats's case, yes, at a professional level. He studied medicine, I think, for 6 years. And he actually wrote poetry, I think, for about three.
Which actually came first?
The medicine. He was apprenticed to a surgeon when he was around 14.
Mm-hmm. Did you find a causal connection here, Hermione? Did one, you know, sort of lead to the other in the sense that he found himself motivated somehow or other, having been a physician, to write about it in his poetry?
I think so, and I think it was both biographical and also a sign of the age, if you will. His mother, his younger brother, and goodness knows how many other people in the family were victims of tuberculosis, as he was later on. Mm. So there was that very strong interest in sickness. And I guess the humanitarian instinct was transferred over from medicine to poetry. In one of his very late poems, The Fall of Hyperion, which he actually did not complete, he says, "A poet is a humanist, a sage, physician to all men."
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, what he's talking about is the poet as the healer of the human spirit. But he's transferring those ideas from some very basic notions that he developed in medical school, and before that, at home, if you will, nursing his mother and brother,
mm-hmm.
which was, again, transferred over to the medical study.
One of the clichés, I think, that we've inherited about Romanticism is that it involves an organic view of the world. Perhaps symbiotic would be the right word. Is that part of Keats's interest in medicine and poetry?
I think so, and I think this is true not just of him, but of all the Romantics. Medicine really isn't a specific science at that time. As far as, people like Goethe and Schelling, Berlioz, even Shelley, and mm-hmm. of course Wordsworth, they all studied medicine, at least for some time. And as far as they were concerned, medicine was the foremost humanistic discipline.
Mm-hmm.
It was the study of man. You could not be helping man more than by studying medicine.
Where did poetry fit into the romantic continuum? If medicine is one element, is poetry a kind of a correspondent healing device?
I think the ideas were transferred over, the one from the other, and I think the people really most responsible for that were the German Romantics
mm-hmm.
and the philosophers. People like Schelling and Schiller. Schiller studied medicine too. They developed, or at least emphasized, the notion of the poet-physician,
mm-hmm.
the poet as a physician. So you get both an ideological influence on Keats and then the very practical study of medicine. The interest in poetry and medicine, I think I'm inclined to say that there was always an interest in medicine, and that eventually the interest in helping humanity, or specifically in helping suffering humanity, was transferred to poetry. In the past, and certainly until Robert Giddings started to emphasize the medical aspects of Keats's intellectual life, poets, and I really think it's the late 19th century poets, the pre-Raphaelites and the decadents, who sort of picked up Keats and said, you know, this is an example of high romanticism. He's sensuous and nothing else. There's just this heavy-weighted voluptuous poetry that doesn't mean a thing. It's just somewhat short on meaning, but it's very pretty. The tendency among Keats's critics of the late 19th century was to say that that he was forced into medicine, that he merely did it for the money, or if you will, for the trade. I think it was a very exciting time, and I think in the history of science, the early 19th century is probably the most interesting period to study, just because there's so much going on. And in some ways, yes, the notions are quite primitive. But in other ways, this is the time when they don't yet have a theory of bacteriology. They don't have a germ theory, but they're just discovering what disease is. They're just discovering the difference between pestilence the morbid poisons and just regular pharmacological poisons. This is also the time when psychology, I suppose, is being established and psychosomatic medicine has a great deal of basis in this time. Because of the steam, this discovery of the steam engine led to one very important thing in many of the disciplines, and that was the steam presses. What the steam presses produced, of course, was a great deal of paper, and it made it possible to disseminate knowledge easily. So there were a lot of journals founded, and by and large, the largest number of journals founded at this time are in medicine. So that what you have is the beginning of the research hospital. The hospitals are in London and Edinburgh, and to a lesser extent in places like Manchester and Dublin, become, really basic modern research hospitals. And there's an exchange of ideas and a swapping of information and a team working and everything else. Mm-hmm. So this really is the dawn of modern medicine, and I think most of the history books say as much. So in that sense, it's wonderfully interesting because all the ideas transfer off into the poetry.
Well, let's talk about some of the specific connections between medicine and the poetry of John Keats. You mentioned a moment ago that one of the judgments that we've gotten away from is that his poetry is all gingerbread. It's all frills and merely
thick, soupy, syrupy stuff.
Yeah. With regard to your project, your research work at the National Humanities Center, are you arguing that the obverse of this is Keats's serious devotion to medicine in poetry?
Quite so, and I think in some ways this is an example of how the humanities really are at the basis of so many of the other disciplines, mm-hmm. and the way we think about the other disciplines. All you really have to do is trace these ideas back to their sources. The medical men and the scientists would be interested in things like the origins of life, vitality, dreams, how the psyche functioned, what was the nature of disease, was it an internal thing or was it something that came from outside? And subjects like that were also the subjects of the poetry. And mm-hmm. all you really have to do is make a list of the subjects that the medical men and the scientists were interested in, go to the poetry, and there it is, in a transmuted and much more profound sense.
Well, I take it that Keats wasn't alone in this. Some very obvious examples, people like Mary Shelley writing about a monster or a
that's
creation.
That's right, but again, that's evolution. Mm-hmm. it's a monstrous evolution or a mm-hmm. monstrous creation, but it's addressed to the same questions. Mm-hmm. Where does life come from? Where does it go wrong? Why does it go wrong?
Where else do you find these broad manifestations of connections between the physical sciences and poetry?
I think you pretty much find it through all the poetry of all that time. Wordsworth believed in the notion of the poet as a physician. Mm-hmm. Wordsworth was interested in the same things that Keats was. Coleridge, if you go to the notebooks and the writings and the table talk and all that, it's full of it. Coleridge was a sick man. It's hard to say how much of that was neurosis. Mm. But his recurring subject is sickness and the source of sickness. And that includes both body and mind.
Well, what does Keats do with it? Give me some specifics.
In the middle to late 18th century and in the early 19th century, there was a great debate, which you see in people like the writings of Coleridge, Wordsworth, and others, between two concepts for the origins of life, vitalism and mechanism. The vitalists said, behind life, behind all the differentiations of life, and remember this is going back into evolution theory, there is this one energy or this one force or this soul or this anima. Mm-hmm. In other words, it was a faintly religious notion that there was some larger presence behind the various manifestations of life. Then, of course, there were the mechanists. The mechanists were largely French, and they said, you know, the human body or any body is just a machine. It's just matter in motion. There's no finer energy behind all that. It's just an organic machine that connects and interrelates and just works. Well, the early generation of Romantic poets in England and also on the continent tended to be vitalists. But by the time you get to people like Keats and Shelley and Byron, mechanism has done its job. The French physiologists have had their influence on these poets. And so they're much more skeptical. They don't quite know. They will not avoid the body. They will not be idealists in the same way that the German Romantics were idealists. I mean, that those terms have suddenly become impossible to live with anymore. Wordsworth and Coleridge managed to live with that sort of thing. These really are a later generation. They are not just post-Waterloo. They are also post-mechanism and mechanistic physiology. And you see this in Keats, because he wants very much to believe that there is more than just this organ that works and works very well usually. And when it doesn't work well, you can find some reason for it. And so he ends up deciding that the way to include the spiritual is to combine them. There's a little poem, I think it's a sonnet addressed to Fanny Braun, that begins, "Physician nature, let my spirit blood." That's what I mean when I say there's an interconnection of the physical and the spiritual. I mean, where do you make the separation there? Mm-hmm. What is the spiritual element and what is the physical element? The physiological is inescapable in Keats. And I think that's one of the reasons why, for a while, he was mistaken for being just a sensualist poet.
Mm-hmm.
Precisely because the images are always, and or at least so often, off the body. No, the body was important for him. He was, as Arthur Henry Hallam said, a poet of sensation. He found his images for his poetry in the body and in the physical, and everything else came out of that. And remember, too, he's a practical physician. He's been experimenting. He's been carving up cadavers and treating people. You know, he's been doing physical things.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, he said, axioms in philosophy are not axioms until they are proved upon the pulses. So there's that basic physical and organic sense to everything that he writes, but that doesn't mean it is not sublime poetry. It's precisely that you begin with the body and you might end with the body, but it's a very different sense of what's there. Again, in the Ode on a Grecian Urn, you have two sides to that urn. One side has an immortal love that is never consummated. The other side has a consummated love that is that turns cloying.
Mm-hmm.
And what Keats is saying is, both are limited unless they are dependent on one another. Both sides are limited. Even in his last long epic poem, The Fall of Hyperion, it declares its subject to be the poetic healing of the human spirit. But what that poem does, at least as it starts out, is to focus on the sensations of the body. The poet's body, his hand, which is a warm scribe, his iced foot, his tongue seeking syllables about its roofed mouth, his heart too small to hold its blood, and the possession of his vital signs by this cold chill that strikes from the pavement. So that what you have is, as Walter Jackson Bate has said, you have a combination of a remote and abstract backdrop, but the sharply analytical consciousness of the body as an anatomical event, both brief and complex.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to a conversation about the English Romantic poet John Keats, who lived from 1795 till 1821. My guest is Hermione de Almeida, a professor of English at the University of Miami, who recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where she worked on a book about the connections between medicine and poetry in the life and writing of John Keats.
Hermione, you're interested, I know, in the interplay between poison and potion in Keats's poetry.
That's true, yes. Now, poison is, poison or medicine, or if you will, the pharmacological substance, is a subject of fascination, not just among the scientists and the medical sorts, but with everyone in the early 19th century. And the reason for this is very similar. If in the 17th century you had a lot of poisoning, now it becomes a fascination in the way in which poisons and medicines function. They know something about these poisons or medicines, but they don't quite know how they function because of the chemistry is still in its infancy. And of course, with all the voyages to America and the South America, people like Alexander von Humboldt and his brother would bring back stories of all these wonderful and strange poisons, and they'd bring back stories of these strange animals that could poison by looking at you. There were notions like there was supposedly a poison tree. It was called the Tree of Java. It was so potently poisonous that nothing lived for a radius of 200 miles. And the only thing that would grow near it was another little poison tree. Now, of course, Keats didn't believe in this, but Erasmus Darwin did. And I think most of the Romantic poets and Byron, Shelley have references to a poison tree. Blake, certainly. I remember, I think it's in the Table Talk, Coleridge says that all remedies are in their effects diseases. Now, what are you going to do with something like that if a remedy is also a disease? I think it goes back to the fact that they don't quite know what diseases are. Diseases are morbid poisons. They're just like snake venom, and they're just like nightshade, and they're just like wolfsbane, hemlock, mm-hmm. And things like that.
Does this have a counterpart in the poetry of the Romantics? That is to say, the good can become the bad. There's a kind of an inverse or even perverse relationship between the two.
Absolutely. It's in fact, it's so incredibly ambiguous. Take the example of Lamia. Uh-huh. Lamia is either a very beautiful woman or a serpent in that particular poem.
Which is she, Hermione?
I would not answer. Uh-huh. I would say
that
she is the paradox of mortal and immortal life.
Uh-huh.
She is either a physical person, or if you will, snake, or seductress, or mm-hmm. a monster, or whatever it is, who seduces this boy and then abandons him and he dies, or else she's an intangible substance. And the real question is Lamia a physical creature, or is she a dream? And this connects with the whole, not just the Keatsian, but the whole romantic fascination with dreams. I mean, they don't know what to do with, they're fascinated with dreams, they think they're the basis for so much poetic activity and achievement, but they don't quite know if they're good or bad for you.
And as it finds its way into romantic poetry, I take it that we have the same kind of hopeless entanglement of health and vigor and disease and corruption. And what Keats, for instance, is trying to figure out is, you mentioned earlier, that one line across which you don't go, physically or spiritually.
That's right. In other words, it's the recognition of that distinction, when in fact, I mean, all the Romantics enjoy the wonderful complexity of all these subjects. I mean, just take the notion of the pharmacon, the pharmaceutical substance, which mm-hmm. is, Apollo was the first pharmacus, or if you will, pharmacist. Pharmacon means, and it means this all the way back, if you take the Greek roots, it means a healing drug, a poison, a dye, as in something into which you dip something to color it or taint it. And it means, therefore, also ink. So there you have this connection between writing, poetic writing, and medicine, and poisoning, and everything else. You just take the subject of dreams. Yes, dreams is an important subject to romantic poetry, the writing of romantic poetry. But are dreams a poisonous substance, or are they a medicinal substance? Do they save you from the world? Do they help you live with the world better? Mm-hmm. Or do they make life much worse?
It sounds, Hermione, as though apart from the conventions of language and the particularly the poetic conventions that the Romantics were used to, we're still very much preoccupied with these things.
I think so, and I guess I would refer back to something he says in a letter of his in 1818, on the eve of his Annus Mirabilis, which is the time when he wrote all the very good poetry that we remember him for. He's writing to, I believe, his brother, and he says, "Until we are sick, we understand not. As Byron says, knowledge is sorrow, and I go on to say that sorrow is wisdom." This is his subject. How do you understand? How do you become a philosopher? How do you learn to live with life, which usually is unpleasant?
And at all these different levels, right?
Yes, and at all these levels. Yeah. And this is his complex. Mm-hmm. And you get it at the end of his last big poem, The Fall of Hyperion, where in effect he takes the role of the poet who is being taught by this goddess, Moneta. And she embodies in a sublime sort of way all the suffering known to mortals and immortals. He says he looks at her face, And what he sees is the picture of sorrow, the picture of pain. But it's removed. It's philosophical. And that's what he's trying to do. And if I may, Wayne, I'd like to refer to an early poem of his where he starts at this. And what you see is Keats, the medical student, who also wants to be a poet. But most of all, what he wants to do is to help humanity. He knows that his vocation, and remember, all the Romantics believe that you had to be a committed, no matter what you did, you had to be committed to what you did. And he knows that his task or his vocation is to help humanity in some way, and that it's specifically it's going to be connected with the suffering of humanity. And I'll refer you to this poem. It's not a good poem, but it is the poem where he suddenly, virtually before your eyes, grows up. It's the Epistle to John Hamilton Reynolds. It's written early in 1818. It's written extemporaneously. He's writing a letter to a friend, and he suddenly decides to write in verse. And it's an extraordinary poem because the friend is sick, and he's writing as a friend, but also in verse as a poet, but also behind that as a physician who is trying to help the friend, who's trying to say all things must pass. The poem begins, and remember, this connects with what I've been saying about dreams. It says, "Oh, that our dreamings all of sleep or wake would all their colors from the sunset take, from something of material sublime, rather than shadow our own soul's daytime in the dark void of night." What he's saying here is, if only all our dreamings, if only everything could take colors from the sunset, in other words, be bright and beautiful, the Titian colors, as opposed to being the Newtonian world of shadows, of black and white and gray.
Mechanism,
mm-hmm. Physical, physiological, as opposed to sublime, metaphysical mm-hmm. dreaming. And this is his subject. And remember, he's starting out here. He's not a poet yet. And he worries about this subject. And he wants to comfort his friend. And he tries. And he's trying to explain, you know, why do we end up in two kinds of moods, either a euphoric mood that can dream and see beautiful things, or the misery of melancholy and depression and darkness and death and all that. And he says, "It is a flaw in happiness to see beyond our bourn. It causes us to, in summer skies to mourn. It spoils the singing of the nightingale." What he means by that, of course, is the human tendency to look beyond, to see a little further. And in this poem, which is also an epistle to his friend, he says, "Dear Reynolds, I wanted to describe a pretty scene, but something mysterious and strange happened to me. Dear Reynolds, I have a mysterious tale and cannot speak it. The first page I read upon a lampet rock of green seaweed among the breakers. 'Twas a quiet eve, the rocks were silent, the wide sea did weave an untumultuous foam of fringe of silver foam along the flat brown sand. I was at home and should have been most happy, but I saw too far into the sea, where every more, the greater on the less, feeds evermore. But I saw too distinct into the core of an eternal, fierce destruction, and so from happiness I was far gone." You see the subject there. The subject is evolution, the one thing preying on another thing. I've gathered young spring leaves and flowers gay of periwinkle and wild strawberry. Still do I that most fierce destruction see, the shark at savage prey, the hawk at pounce, the gentle robin, like a pod or ants, ravening a worm. Away he horrid moods of one's mind. His answer, of course, is the problem with human beings is that they can never be happy. The moment they are in a particular situation where they are content, they have this bad habit of looking to the next moment.
They want to question it.
This is the subject of the Ode on Melancholy. Mm-hmm. At the moment when you are most happy, the seed for future sorrow is planted, and it grows up and it bears a beautiful or ugly flower, and so on.
And the same correlation holds for the connection between health and corruption.
Absolutely. You don't know where that distinction really is, mm-hmm. and I'm not sure you can know, but the task is to know that the one becomes the other.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Keats's answer at the end of this poem is to call these moods of one's mind. In other words, the mind can put itself in the mood to see the beautiful colors, to dream in Titian shades, or it can put itself into the mood of seeing darkness, black and white shadows. And what he, as the poet physician, would suggest was to know that these are only moods. In other words, the real Newtonian world out there is real, but it's also a mood. Likewise, the poetic world of colors and visions and fantastic things is only a mood, but it's also real, and there is no weight given to either the one world or the other. And see, that's how you get the connection between the physical and the spiritual.
Without letting one predominate.
Yeah, in other words, you take the human habit of looking from one mood to the next, to floor its happiness, to see beyond its bourne, and you turn it to philosophical use. Mm-hmm. You look at the sea, and if you see the shark out there, you also think that you will also see what's behind that. Mm-hmm. So that you can transfer yourself from one mood, which might be a good Titian-colored mood, to the next, which might be a vision of horror.
And
but even when you're within that vision of horror, you know that another will follow, mm-hmm. and that it'll be the opposite of that.
And this accounts for the romantic notion that it's benevolent, the whole proposition.
Or if it's not benevolent, at least it's changing, mm-hmm. so that there is no sense of anything being held. You will never stay in one place.
Flux, flow.
Flux is important. Mm-hmm. In other words, the romantic saw potential. I think I quoted Carl Woodring once before in another radio show where I said, in their ignorance and folly, the romantics neglected a great opportunity to be as miserable as we are. In other words, they were optimistic. They knew that one unpleasant scene would give way to another pleasant scene. They could see both the depths and the chasms and the horrors, but they could also see Mont Blanc. They could see the heights. Mm. And that's something that we lost in the 20th century. Or if you were almost any opposites, really, mm-hmm. and this is applicable at all times, action and lack of action, stasis and movement, life and non-life, mm-hmm. which, of course, you find in the Odin and Grecian urn. That is life captured. But is it life? That's mm-hmm. the question. I mean, at the end of the ode, yes, those lovers never kiss, therefore they will never fall out and grow old and die. But then again, they do not kiss. That is the truth of the urn. But that's not the human truth. There is more to that. Mm-hmm. And you see that, if you will, in some ways an answer almost to the Grecian urn and to that moment of the Grecian urn, the captured moment in the Ode on Melancholy, where he says, melancholy embodies that dual state. She dwells with beauty, beauty that must die, and joy whose hand is ever at his lips, bidding adieu, and aching pleasure nigh, turning to poison while the bee mouth sips. See, it's that moment of turning to poison while the bee mouth sips. When does the poison turn poison? As the bee mouth sips because of the bee, because of the flower? When does that transference come? You mm-hmm. don't know.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a discussion about John Keats, the 19th century English Romantic poet. My guest was Hermione de Almeida, a professor of English at the University of Miami, who recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where she worked on a book about John Keats. Next week on Soundings, a conversation with another scholar at the National Humanities Center. William Rorabaugh of the University of Washington will discuss his book, The Alcoholic Republic, An American Tradition. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join me this week for a conversation about John Keats, the 19th century English Romantic poet. My guest is a scholar from the University of Miami who recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center. Hermione de Almeida explains how Keats found in 19th century science and medical knowledge certain ideas and analogies that affected elements central in his poetry, such as health and disease, waking and sleeping, and the distinctions between poison and potion. Physician and humanist, medicine and the poetry of John Keats, this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.